You're listening live to the 10th episode of the Armand and Akil show, bringing you interviews with local activists, politicians, and policy experts from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. I'm Armand Rana.
And I'm Akil Krishnan. It's Saturday, the 4th of November at 5:10 p.m. We are broadcasting live from UBC's Vancouver campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hkmim-speaking Musqueam people.
So how does it feel to be managing the soundboards for the first time, Akil? Are you excited?
Very, actually. Also completely nerve-wracking. This is a very new contraption. I did have one training session, but I seem to have completely forgotten everything in 1 week. However, with your expert advice, I seem to be doing all right so far. Yeah. Look for the comments later.
Yeah. It's I can hear you. I think that's a positive sign. So
we also heard the intro. I think there was a little bit of space between the intro and the radio DJ, but I think I did swimmingly well. What do you think?
Yeah. 10 out of 10. So on today's episode, what are we going to be doing? So we're going to talk a little bit, play some clips about, of course, the ongoing conflict in the Middle East, in Gaza in particular. We're also going to, play some other clips, maybe depending on time permitting, on SBF.
Yes, on some of the big news items right now, SBF, Trudeau's carbon tax reversal, temporary hold.
Yeah, that interesting situation. So I think just to kick things off, did want to, kind of provide some, background for our listeners. Some things that, made us think a bit differently or cause us to reflect. I think, we're bombarded with a lot of media about the, the conflict in the Middle East. And it can be sometimes tricky to, first of all, get something new that doesn't kind of feed into some existing kind of framework that you already have. And I want to start off by maybe reading this piece by, I would say a friend of mine. I haven't spoken to her a long time, but I met her when she was visiting Vancouver. She's a writer, Palestinian writer, who grew up in Gaza. I think she's currently somewhere in Canada. I don't know what she's doing right now. She was fortunate to leave Gaza to get the opportunity to leave Gaza for, I think, graduate studies at Oxford. But this is her recalling her experiences growing up in Gaza.
Take it away.
And this is from the American Middle Eastern Understanding kind of link dispatch that they have. When I was 16, I remember lying down on the floor in our Gaza home right after Israel bombed an UNRWA storage facility, thinking how little value my life had to the world, what kind of a human I had to be for the world to look the other way when my limbs would be torn. I remember hoping I'd be killed with my family and not have to withstand the burden of life if they passed. I remember, in 2018, the dehumanizing pressure of an Israeli airstrike on a TV station a few hundred meters away from my home. Sheltering in the farthest room of the house, my then one-year-old niece, Juju, holding on to my mother, fearing the air pressure would take her away. I remember all of this and know that it was a fraction what every man, woman, and child in Gaza is experiencing every second. I feel all the dehumanization and betrayal amplified 100 times when my brother tells me they fell asleep with their shoes on and their backpacks of essentials on their shoulders, or when my brother can't answer the phone because Juju and her three-year-old brother, Jad, are trembling constantly while their neighborhood is completely level to the ground. When my brother tells me that our father cried while leaving our home in Gaza City, I feel all this pain. But I hope very dearly in my heart, like that 16-year-old girl on the floor, that our fight for life will prevail. I hope that there are those in the world who see my niece as a human being, even as she holds her breath through hundreds of airstrikes. I hope, maybe naively, that freedom isn't just a word, that she will live in a world where she doesn't tremble in fear, that the power of those few of us will triumph against colonialism, racism, and dehumanization, against the brutal and ugly face of humanity.
It's a beautiful piece, very powerful.
Yeah. I think it's, you know, it's important to kind of really humanize, each person who, there's these statistics about civilian casualties and then there's statistics about injuries, and we don't even look at injuries because the casualties, people actually died is number that contend about. But even, the psychological impact of this conflict, on each human being who grows up in this environment, fearing for their life. I think there's a saying by, I hate to bring up Stalin, but, he says one death is a, tragedy and 1,000 is a statistic. And I think really we need to really humanize the people in this, in this conflict, is so important. That's what this piece did for me. Any other reaction that you had to it?
It was, it's like you said, it's it really humanizes the victims of this conflict, civilians who through no act of their own are subjected to this brutality, children especially, and of course it doesn't matter, like a death is a death, but it feels especially tragic and painful when you hear children having to go through this. And I think this piece beautifully captures just how horrifying it is.
Yeah. And the population of Gaza, I think like almost 50% of it is under the age of 18.
Yeah.
So it's incredibly young. It's a city. It's a refugee camp of children. That's what Gaza is to some degree. Do you want to move on to which clips do you have for us?
So I think the first clip that we have, continuing about the Israel-Palestine conflict, this is a new CBC News report of a draft proposal by Israeli intelligence. This is something I haven't listened to before. Ramon, you included this clip.
Yeah.
And curious to hear what they have to say. Let's take a listen. Let's take a listen now.
The leaked Israeli draft paper suggests forcibly transferring Gaza's 2.3 million people across this border into the Egyptian Sinai. Egypt's prime minister visited Sinai and said his country will resist.
So I think we have to look at this as what is called a concept paper and understand that it's not a crime that has already occurred.
This Israeli-American historian says while he doesn't support the idea, Israel will make permanent changes in Gaza.
I think it's only natural for them to lose some territory. And that, by the way, is the oldest language, right? When people attack and then the defenders defend, and at the end of the day, if they win, they have the right to seize territory.
The Palestinian representative in Canada says Israel in the document is showing its true colors.
We have Israel, the occupying and apartheid power, deciding the fate of people it occupies, the way it works for its interests, not taking any consideration of their rights, of their desires.
Two-thirds of Gaza's people are already refugees of previous displacements.
And this would be the same situation, ethnic cleansing, so that Netanyahu could annex Gaza to Israel, as he promised in the map he showed in the United Nations.
In September, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu showed the UN a map he called the New Middle East. It showed an enlarged Israel with Palestinian territories absorbed into it. The draft paper also proposes Canada as a new home for the expelled Palestinians because, it says, Canada has a lenient immigration system.
First of all, there's no reason for Palestinians to be displaced. And second of all, that certainly wasn't discussed with us, and that's not the solution.
The Israeli embassy in Canada told us in a written statement, this is a briefing document leaked in its initial stages. It does not represent the Israeli government's position. Asked whether the Israeli government was committed not to expel Gaza's civilian population, the embassy did not respond. Evan Dyer, CBC News, Ottawa.
Okay, that was a lot. That was a lot in there. That must constitute a violation of international law. Not that Israel is any kind of stranger to violations of like forcible removal and seizure of land, especially in the West Bank. But that's a lot. It's a lot, and Egypt isn't going to do it. Egypt has every reason to want to keep the Palestinians in Gaza, because that would mean that territory remains non-Israeli, right?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think what struck me as well, like I was aware that there are elements in the far right who kind of Israel who basically want to remove.
Sure, I mean one of his cabinet members, Ben-Gvir, is I'm sure said things that are far more outrageous. But to hear the sitting prime minister of Israel say it is a different matter than to have some ultra-nationalist right-wing person who now is part of the cabinet, of course, but say it.
Yeah, but what struck me, though, actually was the part where they said that Canada is a possible destination.
It's that's another part.
It's becoming, you know, so absurd, the kind of the conservative forces in Israel has their kind of the ideology has become so absurd that they want 2 million people to forcibly remove 2 million people from their homes, and if Egypt doesn't take them, to send them halfway across the world. It's really I think refugees, you know, Canada should be doing much more for refugees. I think
sure, but you cannot use Canada's general look on amnesty for refugees. Well, we could be doing more. But the fact that we do more than our nearest neighbor, the United States, did in the past, let's say 4 to 4 to 6 years. But the justification given that because Canada has a lenient immigration system, to advocate for the forcible removal of 2 million people.
It would be laughable if it was not so, like, so disturbing. You know?
Yes.
It's so.
But it's the absurdity of it. Like you said, to forcibly remove 2 million people and fly them off across the world to a totally different in a different part of the world, and just with complete disregard for the fact that for whether these people actually want to leave and whether they want to they actually do want to go somewhere else.
It's absurd. And as you said, you know, the most important point, which is what you said at the beginning, is that, you know, this is of course a violation of all international law, the forceful removal, and what is currently happening, you know, underway in Gaza, where residents are being told to leave northern Gaza, and that's already they're basically being forcibly removed from that part of Gaza. That's already, you know, violation of international law, and as you said, Israel is no stranger to that. But this is just like the next order, kind of the logical conclusion of where this policy is going.
Egypt,
and let's talk about that as well. You're bringing this up before the show. You know, what is Egypt's position on all this? Like they basically closed the border,
the Rafah border crossing.
What are your thoughts on that? Do you want to give some bit of background to our listeners about, you know, the Rafah border crossing, just put it in context what that means?
So Gaza is surrounded on, do you want to say, two sides by Israel, Israeli land. And the third side is the sea, which is blockaded by Israel. I think they can go out up to 5 miles to fish, which is all they can do without running afoul of the Israeli Coast Guard. the only border that is non-Israeli is with Egypt and the Sinai Peninsula. Now, the Rafah border crossing has been blockaded since 2007, I want to say, shortly after Israel started blockading Gaza.
I think when Morsi government Egypt took over, Hamas is an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood.
Right.
And the Muslim Brotherhood briefly took over Egypt.
After the revolution that ousted Mubarak, yeah.
Yeah. And during that period, for a short amount of time, they actually reopened the border. I think that was around 2011, 2012. And then when Sisi took over, which was, you know, they basically outlawed the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, they never really meaningfully reopened the border, right?
Right.
Yeah, and so, you know, that's, the other aspect of this as well is that, you know, Egypt is contributing to the conditions in Gaza as well.
Exactly, yes.
By not allowing any movement across that border.
Right.
Like, it's one thing to, you know, resist the forceful displacement of 2 million people,
yeah,
you know, across the border, which is, you know, understandable.
Yeah. But,
basically, it's a shut. No.
But to continue to blockade it, right? Yeah, and and even be especially, like, particularly even seemingly resistant at the beginning to let people of other nationalities leave through the Rafah border crossing, which they only did more recently. Yeah. Not that the priority should be more for these people, but just that it's a complete blockade is what I'm trying to say, right? And it's interesting that, like, there's a side that what Israel is doing is Israel is committing atrocities against the people of Gaza by forcibly removing them, by bombing civilians. And then the other side of other Middle Eastern countries saying that what Israel is doing are atrocities, but not doing anything really meaningful to help the people of Gaza or the Palestinians in Gaza.
And especially Egypt. You know, I think it's important to emphasize Egypt because, you know, the other Middle Eastern countries, they're kind of geographically located in different places. But Egypt, you know, especially, could very meaningfully, practically be helping, you know, Gaza more. Okay, cool. It's all cool, but...
moving on.
Moving on to the next episode.
Let's have a quick ad break before we go on to the next clip. How does that sound?
Slice of Life Art and Gift Shop is Vancouver's choicest destination for one-of-a-kind artist-made prints, posters, screen prints, riso prints, paintings, acrylic paintings, watercolor paintings, ceramic mugs, ceramic plates, ceramic bowls, ceramic pots, lapel pins, hats, toques, crochet bathing suits, jewelry, trinkets, knickknacks, hand-painted signs, curated thrift, and a bunch more stuff that won't fit in this designated block of airtime. Slice of Life Art and Gift Shop, located at 1636 Venables, just off Commercial. Open 11 to 6, 6 days a week.
MRG presents Garrett T. Willie at the Wise Hall, performing his debut album, Same Pain. This 23-year-old from Kingcome Inlet offers the world something it has genuinely been missing for a while. A contemporary take on hardscrabble blues and the purest, rawest rock and roll. Don't miss Garrett T. Willie's show at the Wise Hall on December 2nd. And be sure to catch his in-studio performance and interview on Noise Complaint by CITR 101.9, also on December 2nd.
Do you love being caffeinated? And do you hate that greedy, soulless international conglomerates are succeeding in the cutthroat world of coffee? Sounds like local coffee roasters Trek Coffee is for you. Trek Coffee is 100% indigenous and military veteran owned and operated. Let's keep small businesses thriving. Stop by Sunshine Convenience on 4th, the Super Value on Commercial, or Grocery Checkout in the Nest to pick up some Trek coffee today.
Students of UBC, join us. Join the SSN, a collaboration between the C4 Choral Composition Club, and the Music Production Club. With us, you can find someone with whom to collaborate, someone with whom to make music. All skill levels welcome. ssn@gmail.com. Reach out. Together, we can make music. Join us.
You're listening live to the Armand and Akil Show on CITR 101.9 FM. This is a special episode where we're playing some clips and reacting to them. We're discussing right now the Israel-Palestine conflict. And we have one more clip that kind of segues into what we were talking about slightly a little earlier about about forcible removal of people and Israel's actions in the West Bank.
Yeah, and I think it might be good to set this up a bit. That Palestine right now is largely divided into two areas. There's Gaza, which is a narrow strip of land between Israel and Egypt, which is operated by Hamas, which is a kind of Islamic organization that has not officially recognized Israel in any meaningful way.
Right.
They are kind of designated as a terrorist organization by the Canadian government, for example. Yeah. There's also the West Bank, which is operated by the Palestinian Authority, which is basically recognizes Israel. What else is there to say? They're actually not in any. They don't actually at this point.
And they don't have a militant wing. Yeah. They're the Palestinian organization that's committed to a two-state solution.
At this point, yeah.
At this point,
and yeah. A negotiated solution.
A negotiated solution, yes. So this next clip is an interview that Piers Morgan did of an Egyptian comedian, Bassem Youssef, who is married to a Palestinian. So he has his wife, who's Palestinian, his wife's family is in Gaza right now. And so he has a unique perspective on this. And this clip from this interview, he talks about how, you know, a lot of people today, right now, are saying that Hamas must be destroyed. Therefore, any actions taken in order to achieve that goal is justifiable. And he just makes a very good point about that.
And you know what? I'm going to be even ahead of you because I see the question coming. Do you condemn Hamas for the atrocity? Yes, I condemn Hamas. Mm. Hamas is the source of all evil. They are the reason for evil. And you know what? Let's, for a minute, imagine a world without Hamas.
Right.
What will this word look like? Mm. Let's give this word a name, and let's name this word the West Bank. Hamas has absolutely no control in the West Bank. And since the beginning of this year, only through August, 37 Palestinian kids were killed. Mm. No music festival, no paragliding, no Hamas. Mm. Since the occupation of the West Bank, 7,000 Palestinians were killed. No music festival, no paragliding, no Hamas. Mm. I can go on and on and on and on.
No, but you don't need...
So that was just him pointing out that the occupation in the West Bank does regularly produce many, many casualties. And there's no identifiable enemy organization in the West Bank like there is in Gaza. So it's important when civilians are enrolled to proceed with caution to ensure that, you know, you obey international law. And at the end of the day, there should be no parallel drawn between a democratically elected government in Israel and an organization that's designated a terror organization, right? Hamas. So to basically say, look, Hamas did this, so we should be able to do this. Like, yeah, but you're not Hamas.
Yeah, yeah, I think the point about the West Bank is very important, because right now there's so much settlement, you know, in the West Bank. I don't know. I think the population is between 500,000 to 1 million people.
About that, yeah.
Live in the West Bank outside of the internationally recognized borders. So there's something called, I think, the 1967 borders, right, which are the internationally recognized borders of Israel, and there's the occupied territories, and there's settlements in the occupied territories where they've built, you know, skyscrapers and all sorts of communities of Israeli nationals living in the West Bank, which is outside of, you know, internationally recognized borders of Israel. And there's like, there's close to between 500,000 and 1 million people, Israeli people, living there at this point. And yeah, they continue to expand settlement in that part of the world. And there, you know, there are different, you know, types of Israeli settlement. There's some people who settled in areas of the West Bank because it was subsidized housing 30 years ago, that there's a government program by Israel. So it was, the cost of living is cheaper. In the same way, you know, some people might choose to live in the, not in Vancouver proper, but in some of the suburbs around Vancouver for cost of living and quality of life.
Right.
And then there are others who moved to the West Bank in terms of almost ideological, who are trying to contribute to the project of displacing the Palestinians and of seizing what they view as, you know,
rightfully greater
Israel. Mm. And that's where, you know, and basically the actual Palestinians who live there are not considered, the Palestinians who live in the West Bank are not considered nationals of Israel. At the same time, they're subject to the laws, to the arbitrary detentions, to
the checkpoints, the surveillance, the demolition of houses.
Yeah. But yeah.
We're going to pivot now to the Western Hemisphere. Another very big story, not in the same way, but in a very different way, in a very different, in a very different sphere.
This is like the hardest segue that you're going to have to...
I will ever have to do, yes. This next... a couple of clips are about Sam Bankman-Fried, who just yesterday the trial reached its verdict. So what I want to do is first play a clip from an interview that Sam Bankman-Fried did that in his own words, he describes what he views as the consequences of his actions and how culpable he is.
Do you want to give some background? Maybe some people don't know who Sam Bankman-Fried is. What is FTX?
Okay. So in a nutshell, Sam Bankman-Fried founded the now defunct cryptocurrency exchange FTX in 2019 and then domiciled it in the Bahamas. Now, FTX reached like a stratospheric valuation of many billions of dollars within a year or so, within about 18 months of its founding, and had investments from a lot of very important VCs, private equity firms, and had the support through advertisements of many very popular celebrities. Now, FTX also had a sister firm called Alameda Research, which basically made risky bets on cryptocurrency fluctuations, on the volatility of cryptocurrencies. Now, Sam Bankman-Fried and FTX dealt in a less than good faith manner about customer funds deposited in FTX. And the separation between FTX and Alameda Research, which should have been completely separate, kind of like how you have a traditional...
He was owner of both, right? He was CEO of one.
CEO of one, and he was...
The owner of
his
both.
Ex-girlfriend was the CEO of the other, and
he owned
the other one, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So in a nutshell, that's who Sam Bankman-Fried is, and that's FTX.
This is billions of dollars.
Billions. And
I think the total whole of lost money is like... What's the order of magnitude in terms of loss? It's in
tens of billions of dollars. Yeah. So he was obviously arrested, extradited to the United States, and he was put on trial for wire fraud, racketeering, a number of other charges. There were some charges that were separated from this trial that will begin in a second trial in May. So let's hear from Sam Bankman-Fried about what he believes, what he thinks about his own actions and his culpability for this same. Let's take a listen to that now.
I was CEO of FTX, and that means whatever happened, whatever it happened, I had a duty to all of our stakeholders, to our customers, our creditors. I had a duty to our employees, to our investors, and to the regulators in the world, to do right by them, to make sure the right things happened at the company. And clearly, I didn't do a good job of that. Clearly, I made a lot of mistakes or things I would give anything to be able to do over again. I didn't ever try to commit fraud on anyone. I was excited about the prospects of FTX a month ago. I saw it as a thriving, growing business. I was shocked by what happened this month. And, you know, reconstructing it, were there things I wish I had done differently?
So that's Sam Bankman-Fried in an interview with CNBC Television, in his own words. And now let's take a listen to a report that CNBC did yesterday after the trial reached its verdict.
Fried found guilty on all seven criminal counts in the FTX fraud trial. He's facing more than 100 years in prison. The verdict coming in right before 8 p.m. Eastern time. And Kate Rooney was there in the room where it happened.
Yeah, there's a lot going on there, Andrew. So the U.S. attorney called this one of the biggest financial frauds in American history. The verdict coming almost exactly a year after his crypto company filed for bankruptcy. Sam Bankman-Fried was convicted across the board on seven counts of fraud and conspiracy on lenders, investors, and customers. It was an emotional scene inside that courtroom last night. Bankman-Fried's father burying his head in his hands. His mother was crying as that verdict was read. The defendant, Bankman-Fried, staring straight ahead, looking pretty stoic during all of this. The jury came back with a lightning-fast verdict. They started deliberating around 3 p.m., broke for dinner at 6 p.m. The verdict came in around 7:45 last night. And in a news conference, guys, Damian Williams, U.S. attorney for the...
So what do you think about that, Armand?
Yeah, I think my initial reaction was I was just surprised at how quickly the jury came to a verdict in that case. Mm. Just because of how complex some of the, you know, financial,
the nature of the
technological shenanigans. Exactly. Like cryptocurrency is the intersection of, you know,
the complexity of finance,
financial,
the complexity of computers.
Yeah, financial intentionally confusing people with financial instruments, and intentionally, defrauding and confusing people with technology.
Yeah, and by the way, cryptocurrency also has the aspect of being containing some incredibly interesting mathematics.
You can throw that in as well, right? So you can just, it's very easy to confuse people, and it's very difficult to honestly understand what you're buying, what services you're buying. And for the jury to come to a decision so fast, I think, to me, kind of points to the fact that, you know, ordinary people kind of have a sense that if something's very complex and confusing and it allows you to cause so much, you know, impact in
mayhem.
people's lives, it is, from their perspective, it is fraud, even if you could, you know,
even if you didn't understand the technicalities of it.
Yeah.
And the legal technicalities too, right? Because you're applying
okay, that's also legal confusion that
exactly.
can also add to it, right? So yeah, that's kind of my initial reaction. I think the other thing is I'm always struck by with SBF and FTX in particular is I remember listening to this Odd Lots past podcast, and Odd Lots is a great podcast. You should check it out, about, you know, weird financial things going on. But I think it's by Bloomberg. A few months, I think 6 months before FTX collapsed. And at that time, he was probably at the peak of his, you know, valuation. Probably FTX was worth between $20 and $30 billion. And he was advising, you know, the world about, advising the American government about
Congress,
how to regulate cryptocurrencies. And he, at one point, basically started talking about this magic box that people put money into and there's nothing actually in the box, but because they think there's it's valuable, it gets kind of value and people take money out. And it basically, the interviewer, one of the guests, basically said, you know, that sounds like a Ponzi scheme. And he kind of acknowledged that comment that, yeah, you know, it's a Ponzi business.
SBF did?
Yeah, yeah. Basically, I think he was referring to the fact that, you know, he wasn't saying he himself.
No, but he was basically saying cryptocurrencies are, their valuation is out of thin air. Is what he was saying. We all agree that they have value, so they have value.
He basically was, and that's kind of what struck me as well with this thing is that it wasn't like his own view of the business he was doing was kind of that it was kind of a charade as well.
His own view of the business that he was engaged in was that it was about as hollow as it comes.
Yeah.
Right. And there was no real substance to it. But he's like, well, but there's value there.
Yeah. It's just perceptions of value is value in and of itself.
Yeah.
Right. But yeah. What are your thoughts?
I think this was expected. And I think based on a conversation that we had, this kind of brings back to mind a conversation we had at the start of the trial of why he didn't plead guilty. So I think the fact that they had his roommate, who's co-founder, Gary Wang, they had the CEO, his ex-girlfriend, also CEO of Alameda Research, the sister firm that he owned.
Caroline Ellison.
They, all of these...
Rashad Singh.
Yeah, all of these people had become...
India Represent.
You always got to say that. Are you sure it's not Bharat?
Okay.
But all of these people who had turned state's witness against him, I think pretty much ensured that he was going to get convicted, right? These people were in the inner circle.
Yeah.
What? The only thing surprising me is that he didn't plead guilty. I thought he didn't do it because they wouldn't have offered him a deal. But he could have probably gotten some leniency if he just pled guilty and said, "I what I did was wrong. I shouldn't have done it. And I know that you're going to sentence me to whatever you're going to sentence me, but I'm pleading guilty." And also, he could have saved his family the humiliation of a trial, right?
Or he could have pleaded guilty to some of the charges. He got found guilty on all seven charges. I think
there are still charges pending, by the way, that were severed from this trial that are going to start in May.
Oh, my gosh.
But in the course of this trial, one of the other things that came out was just the involvement of his parents, who were, until this point, respected law professors and law and other... They were respected professors at Stanford and in the community. Their reputations are on the line. His father was revealed to have been on Signal chats during FTX's collapse with the inner circle discussing the. So basically, he could have avoided humiliation for his family, kind of the quantum of the sentence he's facing, potentially.
And he's probably going to spend the rest of his life in
almost certainly. Yeah. Almost certainly. There's no way he gets anything. The quantum of losses, there's no way he gets anything where he sees he's a free man ever again. But then again, it just goes to show that he's a gambling man. He thought he could you know, roll the dice with a trial and maybe he gets off scot-free.
Yeah. All right. What do we have next?
So what do we have next? So now we are going to come home now to Canada, and we're going to look at Justin Trudeau, lovely Prime Minister, and his reversal on the carbon tax. So Ramon, do you want to set this up a little bit?
Yeah, so it's a bit of a reversal. I think it's better. I think you know, he provides enough background. I'll maybe talk a bit. I'll provide some context after. But basically, the carbon tax was introduced. Federal carbon tax was introduced by Trudeau. It was kind of a signature policy.
Yes.
To fight climate change. I think we need to be doing a lot more to fight climate change beyond a carbon tax, but this was kind of his signature.
His first step, if you will.
Yeah. And to be honest, first, this is like his main thing that he's fought two elections on.
No, I understand. But his argument was that this is the first big step we need to take in order to fight climate change as a country.
Yeah. And BC has its own carbon tax, has had one for a very long time, so we're not really impacted by this. And Pierre Poilievre, you know, like Conservative Leaders before him, has been hammering Trudeau on the carbon tax and kind of very effectively, even though if I think inaccurately linking the carbon tax to the inflation that we're seeing, because inflation is a global phenomenon being seen in the US, which doesn't have a carbon tax.
Exactly.
And in, you know, parts of Europe which also don't have carbon tax, for a variety of reasons related to the Ukraine war, related to labor shortages, related to all sorts of things. But yeah, I think Pierre Poilievre has been very effective in that. And so he's kind of limited, kind of reversed the scope of the carbon tax as it applies to heating oil. Let's take a listen.
After months of defending his government's signature policy, Justin Trudeau is walking back part of the carbon tax.
But we have to make sure we're fighting climate change in ways that supports all Canadians. That is why today we are announcing a 3-year pause on the federal pollution price on heating oil.
Along with temporarily dropping the tax on heating oil, it's also doubling the rebate for Canadians. And there will be new incentives to switch to heat pumps starting on the East Coast. There is no doubt which part of Canada the pressure was coming from.
We heard our Atlantic MPs and we heard Atlantic Canadians.
Those seats in Atlantic Canada have helped the Liberals stay in power since 2015. For some in the region, the announcement is long overdue.
We don't buy orange juice as often as we used to, because that's a luxury.
For months, Christine McCallum is...
What do you think of the reversal on the carbon tax?
Yeah, it's a non-reversal reversal, right? It is a reversal, but they're basically spinning it as something that they realize after the fact. They went like, this is something that's impacting a demographic we didn't think it would impact. So let's create a carve out. The carbon tax does give most of that money does find its way back into the pockets of people.
It's a rebate. It's a rebate. It's very simple. People think it's very complicated.
Exactly.
Literally, the federal carbon tax program has a rebate system.
Exactly.
Where you receive money back in climate rebates.
In a way, it's like a consumption tax rebate, right? Like where you get a GST HST credit if you're lower income, and basically what it does is if you're going to be emitting more carbon by driving cars, by buying gasoline, et cetera, you would pay more in a carbon tax. Someone who doesn't do that, someone with lower income, will get a lot of the money they pay back.
80% of Canadian households get more back in the federal carbon tax than they pay.
Exactly. So it's more about leveling.
So the idea that in terms of inflation, you know, if it has an impact on inflation, it's not the way it's being narrated that, like, oh, the price of my food is going up because of the carbon tax, because you're actually getting that money back.
Exactly.
So in terms of your cost of living, you're actually better off with the carbon tax. 8 out of 10 Canadians are just, like, mathematically better off with the carbon tax than without it. In terms of the matter of perception, right?
The opposition party obviously has a reason to hammer it, because it's just they're not for any sort of anything they see as big government or government intervention.
Or any action on climate change.
Any action on climate change.
At this point, exactly. Right? Like, I don't know what is Pierre Poilievre's climate policy. I think, you know, when you go into the specifics of this, you know, I think it does, like, from a policy perspective, the argument is valid that, okay, this heating oil already is much more expensive than other forms of oil. There's already a financial incentive to move away from it. So there's no point, and it's disproportionately used by low-income people.
Right.
So you can make, you know, a logical data-driven argument for it, but just the politics of it, if there was a logical data-driven reason you had the carve-out, that should have been set up from the beginning.
Right.
Right? After the fact, to open the door to carve-outs to the carbon tax, after you fought 2 elections of it, in a moment of being hammered on it by your political opponent, now, you know, premiers all across Canada are rightfully saying, hey, a lot of our people depend on this other energy source for heating. Give us a carve out.
Exactly.
Right? And it's just, it basically feeds into the narrative that the carbon tax actually does contribute to cost of living.
Yeah. And it's, like you said, right, it's this idea that, oh, we didn't think about it. We didn't think what impact it would have. you spend years saying that this is the way to go. You have to have considered all of this, right?
Yeah.
And now, and again, like you said, the premiers now think I can get concessions if I
squeeze,
yell,
squeeze my MPs enough.
Yeah, exactly. If I yell loud enough and squeeze my MPs enough, we can get concessions out of this policy,
yeah.
And it would be a huge step back.
It's a race to the bottom.
Yeah,
a race to the bottom.
Absolutely. So we've got just a few minutes left. I think we can play one more clip, and we'll quickly discuss it. Unless you have something else you want to.
Yeah, let's do that. So the next clip. I think the next clip is actually from. We don't really cover sport very much, but it's from the captain of the South African rugby team after the World Cup win. And let's take a listen, and I'll give some context away.
For sure. Just to provide some context for what you just said, the Rugby World Cup just concluded last weekend with the South African team, the Springbok, beating the New Zealand All Blacks. I want to say 12 to 11. Yes, 12 to 11. That's right. Okay, so let's take a listen to this.
Well, Sia, congratulations. Back-to-back Rugby World Cup wins. Tell me about this moment right now for you.
Well, there's no ways I can explain it in words. I want to give credit to the All Blacks. They took us to the end. They took us to a tough place. It just shows what kind of team they are to fight with the men down from early in the game. And they fought and they put us so much under pressure. But yeah, credit to my boys too for that fight. Yeah, I'm just grateful we could pull it off.
Tell me about that contest tonight. There was drama, there were cards on both sides. How do you think your side managed to just hold it together?
Well, we had to. We lost our hooker in the early part of the game. And then we obviously had to adjust to that. There's a lot of pressure on us. They put a pressure on our lineouts. But we found a way. Somehow we found a way. And honestly, I don't think people that are not from South Africa don't understand what this means for our country. You know, it's not just about the game on the field. You know, our country goes through such a lot, and we are that bearing hope that they have. You know, and yeah, we're just grateful that we can be here. And I just want to tell the people of South Africa, thank you so much. Children from a third world country, you know, who just fight and fight over and over, you know, for people that need hope. And this team just shows what diversity can do. All is possible, no matter in what sphere, you know, on the field, in off we can do for our team, you know, for our country as well. As soon as we work together, all is possible, no matter in what sphere, you know, on the field, in offices, it just shows for what we can do there, and I'm grateful for this team. I'm so proud of it.
Huge congratulations. See you. Well done.
Thank you so much.
Take it away, Roman.
Yeah.
Apparently, I'm not super proficient at the boards just yet. Please go ahead.
Yeah, I think the thing that I want to highlight, that South Africa actually is going, we might cover in a later episode, is going through a really tough time with, you know, power outages and, you know, so much, you know, corruption, scandals unfurling. And it's just a you know, loss of hope. The economic conditions are not great. A lot of social strife and tensions there. And yeah, I think, you know, the message of, you know, that he had about, you know, the South African rugby team, right, is made up of black South Africans as well as a lot of Afrikaans South Africans who had a very similar kind of social structure of segregation 30 years ago,
yeah,
which is less than half a lifetime away.
Mm.
And now, you know, arm in arm, they're winning, you know, the most, you know, physically demanding World Cup final together year after year. Like, they won the last World Cup too under the same captain, yeah. Right? And yeah, I think, you know, especially when you think about the, you know, Israeli conflict, and it really goes to show that, you know, a better world is possible, I guess, where people of different backgrounds can actually work together rather than the current state of affairs.
It's a beautiful message to take us out. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to the Armand and Kill Show, 101.9 FM. We've just this is the end of our show. We have a few other things to wrap up. You can find us at The Armani Kill on Instagram and Twitter, so check us out there. The music tonight was composed by the incredibly talented...
Unbelievably talented.
Amazingly capable Sarah Pratt. You can find her music on SoundCloud at Leisure Noise. We do have some awesome shows lined up with a set of awesome guests. Do continue to listen and subscribe. You can find all of our episodes on our podcast feeds. Do check them out. Have a good night and take care.